If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. What do we get wrong about the Anglo-Saxons? Well, as it turns out, plenty. In today's episode, Mark Morris, the author of a new book on the Anglo-Saxons, challenges some of the widely held assumptions about the period, from the early 5th century through to the Norman Conquest. Mark recently wrote a feature for the June issue of BBC History Magazine on the conversion of Anglo-Saxons to Christianity. He spoke here to our content director, David Musgrove.
Today I'm joined by Mark Morris, best-selling author of several books on medieval history, whose latest book is The Anglo-Saxons, A History of the Beginnings of England. Now that's a big topic and several centuries of history to cover. So what I've asked Mark to do is pick out the key misconceptions about the period and bust them for us. Now, everyone loves to see a misconception busted, so hopefully this will set a few things straight. Mark, hello. Welcome back to the podcast. You've been on more than once or twice before. Thanks for coming back. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Dave. It's always a pleasure.
Good, good stuff. So we're going to have a go at busting these misconceptions. So you sent me a list of things that you think perhaps people might be misinformed about, and we're just going to run through them and see what happens. So The first one you sent me was that the Anglo-Saxons didn't displace the native Romano-British population. So that's an interesting one, which takes us right back to the start of the story. So you better just tell us a little bit about where we're at with the start of this period and the end of Roman Britain, I guess.
Yeah, well, I thought it was a good place to begin, the beginning, as you say, the end of Roman Britain, so circa the year 400. And the debate about the Anglo-Saxons and the origins of the Anglo-Saxons is how many newcomers there were in the course of the 5th and 6th centuries. And the old idea, going back to the sort of the Anglo-Saxons themselves in the stories they told themselves in the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries, was that they had defeated the Romano-British, they defeated the Britons in battle and driven them into the extremities of Britain. So, you know, Cornwall, Wales, Cumbria, etc. And, you know, for a long time that was taken on trust. And then, as early as the 19th century, but particularly in the 20th century, people said, well, hang on a minute, it can't have been the case that there was kind of a total genocide here and the British were either wiped out or driven out. It simply doesn't work like that. And the debate has raged ever since about, you know, to what degree newcomers replaced the existing population. And it's clear that there was the newcomers, the Anglo-Saxons, must have been a minority. The question is to what extent they were a minority, and nobody agrees on this. I think there is modern scholars are closer to consensus, most of them, than they would have you believe. And I think nowadays the broad consensus is that the level of immigration from, we'll come on to where they're from, was the level of immigration was sizable, but nothing like large enough to replace the people who are already in situ. And the direction they're coming from, by and large, is Northern Europe and Southern Scandinavia. So Bede, famously. I mean, the problem for this period, of course, is, before we get into that, we have virtually no written evidence. Hardly anything at all from the 5th century worthy of mention. We've got some continental chroniclers who mention this process in passing. In the 6th century, early 6th century, we have a British writer called Gildas, who his main agenda is not to talk about this, but he does have a historical introduction to his rant about the deficiencies of modern British rulers in the 6th century. And then later on, we've got the famous telling of the story, which is by the Venerable Bede in the early 8th century. But, you know, by that stage, Bede is writing 3 centuries after the events he's describing. So his account has already become a sort of legendary account, if you like. And Bede says that the Anglo-Saxons came from three very powerful Germanic peoples, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes. The Jutes, of course, are the sort of like, you know, the junior partner in all of this. They sort of get written out of the compound Anglo-Saxon later on. And I think Jutes is largely included because one of Bede's major sources was a friend in Kent who was giving him the lowdown on kind of Hengist, Horsa, and his other Kentish legends. So the rulers of Eastern Kent, at least, like to think that they were descended from the Jutes. But these are three peoples that hailed from northern Germany. But the thing that's the famous part of Bede. The less famous part, there are less famous passages in Bede where he says, well, the English, I think he says the Angles and the Saxons, from whom the Angles and the Saxons were drawn for lots of different German peoples, and he rattles off several other names as well. So, you know, they are coming from everywhere in that area, and that I think one of the crucial misconceptions is that, you know, kind of fostered. Particularly with people in England from their childhood, when they do this period, of course, you do this period at primary school in England or in Britain, is that they come over in discrete groups. So Bede fosters that misconception that the Angles came from Angel and the Saxons came from Saxony, and they all settled in these discrete groups in Britain. And of course, it can't have been like that. It's wave after wave of people coming over and mixing it up as they go. So you've got people coming from Frisia, you've got people coming from Jutland, you've got people coming from southern Scandinavia. At some point, however, these people decide, you know, that they have a corporate identity and that some of them are Angles and some of them are Saxons. But even that is not set in stone. And one of the things that's very interesting is Bede in the early 8th century says, well, they come, you know, the Angles come over, the Saxons come over, and that's why we have. He immediately goes into, you've got the West Saxons, the East Saxons, the South Saxons, of course, giving us Wessex, Sussex, and Essex. You've got the East Angles, you've got the Mercians who are Angles, and you've got the Northumbrians who are Angles. That's where Bede himself is writing. But when you look at the way the rulers of these polities style themselves in the 7th and indeed the 8th centuries, they're again mixing it up. You find kings of Northumbria styling themselves as Saxon kings, and you find monks who are from Wessex, West Saxon people on the continent, describing themselves as Angles. So there's quite a lot of fluidity in the way that these two apparently separate concepts of, two separate peoples, that to some extent they're interchangeable terms.
Now, there is this live debate about whether we should be talking about the Anglo-Saxons as at all as a concept, which feeds into lots of things that are going on today in terms of nationalism and big debates in that sense. You've chosen to call your book the Anglo-Saxon, so you think is an appropriate term still?
Well, I think it's an unavoidable term. I mean, as I say, we these people call themselves Angles and Saxons. And from from the 8th century on the continent, you have a few instances of people calling, using the phrase Anglo-Saxon. But that's as a way of differentiating the Angles, or rather the Saxons in what becomes England, from the Saxons on the continent. So the English Saxons, if you like. But then in the 9th century, you have a king of Wessex, a very famous king of Wessex, Alfred the Great, who begins his career as king of Wessex, Rex Saxonum, and about a decade into his reign decides he's going to put a new hat on and starts calling himself a Rex Angle Saxonum. And he's clearly not using that in the sense of English Saxons. He's using it as a way to reach out to the Angles that he has recently annexed to his kingdom. Because Alfred famously, not only does he defeat the Vikings who are threatening his kingdom, he increases the size of Wessex by annexing half of Mercia. And as a way of appealing to his new Anglian subjects in the West Midlands, he starts styling himself as a king of the Anglo-Saxons. And that's, you know, fairly consistently after about 880. His son does the same, Edward the Elder, for another 25 years. And his grandson, so Edward the Elder's son, Alfred's grandson, Athelstan, also begins his career styling himself as an Anglo-Saxon king, king of the Anglo-Saxons. So it is a contemporary, it's a term with contemporary warrant. And although they don't, although they increasingly start to talk about themselves as kings of the English after, say, 927, they still periodically style themselves, occasionally style themselves as kings of the Anglo-Saxons right down to the end of the period. You know, you've got charters of Edward the Confessor in as late as 1061, styling himself Rex Anglo-Saxonum. So, you know, I totally understand the desire to combat racism within medieval studies. Of course, there's, you know, you, who could object to that? But I do worry about abandoning terms which are have contemporary warrant. And I also think there's a, you know, that because there's such long usage of it, going back at least 400 years as a modern term, it's wishful thinking to imagine that you can cease talking about these people as Anglo-Saxons when that's the way that they occasionally describe themselves. It's kind of a bit like, you know, when, you know, the artist formerly known as Prince, if you start talking about early medieval England, people say, well, what do you mean? You say, well, Anglo-Saxon England. You have to kind of invoke it to explain your circumlocutions. So, and I don't think there is an adequate circumlocution. I continue to use it.
Now, look, before we get on to our second misconception, we should just go back one moment, because I think there's a question that we perhaps ought to try and address, which is the collapse of Roman Britain, if that is such a thing. Now, when I was doing my undergraduate degree in archaeology, I wrote an essay on the collapse of Roman Britain, a quite brilliant essay, I recall. And my professor, the late great Professor Malcolm Todd, underlined in red pen where I wrote, in 410 AD, the rescript of Honorius meant that the Romans left Britain or something like that, which was clearly a very naive and ill-informed statement to make. But what is the reality of the situation regarding the end of Roman Britain, and do the archaeological and the historical sources clash?
These are big questions for someone who, as you know, is a newcomer to this field. You'll notice, because I think you've looked at least the beginning of the book that I've written, that I don't mention the rescript of Honorius. So I think I've avoided the red pen in that regard. The way you pose it, I have to say, is mischievous, because it's an impossible question to answer. Because, as well, you know, the source material, the written source material, is virtually non-existent, and so how you interpret the archaeological material is kind of, you know, that's why there's so much scope for debate. I was persuaded, because I'm not an archaeologist, but I was persuaded by the view that suggests it was catastrophic. So the withdrawal of the Roman state around the turn of the 4th and 5th centuries had calamitous effects on the level of population. I mean, we're told that Roman Britain, the population was somewhere between 2 and 6 million, which gives you some idea. That enormous wide range gives you some idea of how limited the information is. But even if we take it at its lowest estimate, 2 million, where we have more solid information in 1086, because we've got Doomsday Book, the population of late 11th century England is reckoned to be not much more than 2 million. So at its very lowest estimate, Roman Britain is supposed to have 2 million. It could have had three times that much, according to some people. And we know the population is growing throughout the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries. So in order to explain that, you have to sort of say, well, where did all these people go in the 5th century? So the population suffers enormously. And the Roman state, there had been, again, I'm sort of speaking a bit out of school here, but my understanding is that a lot of the, there was a great deal more agriculture as opposed to the pastoral economy that the Anglo-Saxons prefer, which means you can feed more mouths if you have more cereal crops. Once that starts to collapse, then you can feed fewer mouths, then, you know, the population diminishes, which is a kind of polite way of saying there must have been famine, there must have been shortages, there must have been scarcity. And I think, you know, this is, again, one of the things that struck me. You know, when you've got not very much evidence, the arguments become more impassioned, you know, and people say, well, how can you believe that? And you're foolish for believing this. And that's one of the things that struck me, because I cut my teeth in the late Middle Ages, where you can sort of say, well, the king was here on this day and he had these people with him. And it's very, very well documented, particularly if you're doing late medieval English history, as I did. But when you actually kind of look at what people do, even if they sort of take quite different views on the subject, it makes me sound like a consensualist, but I was struck by the people who think of themselves as diametrically opposed saying quite similar things. So, I mean, one of the people that one of the books I enjoyed reading was Guy Halsall's work, Worlds of Arthur in particular. He is someone who takes a minimal view of migration, but not an extreme minimal view. And it was his book that I quote in chapter one. And I said, you know, I think the phrase he uses was like, this is probably the most profound, you know, social collapse in all of British history following the withdrawal of the Roman state. So it's a line I kind of thought, well, I'm having that because, you know, I was persuaded by that view. Someone who, you know, is a historian who, you know, Halsall doesn't see eye to eye with on lots of things is Brian Ward Perkins. But he would take a similar view in terms of the scale of the collapse. So you will find people, you will inevitably find people where there is no evidence taking a more benign view and saying, actually, things rolled along much as they had done in the past. But from all the people I sort of read around, it seemed to me that the argument for catastrophe at the start of the 5th century was the most convincing argument.
Okay, so we've got a picture there of pretty dark days at the start of the 5th century. And then after a while, we do get some polities, some things that are now called kingdoms. And that moves us on to your second misconception, which is that everyone thinks there were originally 7 kingdoms. So when did those kingdoms start to develop and where does that 7 kingdom idea come from?
Well, there's two misconceptions there. The one that we deal with quickly is the you said sort of after a while we get kingdoms. Well, it's a good long while. I mean, you know, again, going back to the history I was taught at school 30 plus years ago when I was, you know, because I say we the problem with the Middle Ages in general is we're taught all this stuff when we're quite young and it does sit in our brains forever. So you do the Anglo-Saxons when you're at primary school or when you're at the beginning of your secondary school career. So you don't analyze them in any detail. Same with the Norman conquest, you know, but so that is hard sometimes to take people back to stuff they learnt when they were very little because it's kind of hardwired into their brain. I mean, I grew up in Kent, and so the story we would talk was Hengist and Horsa, you know, the first kings of Kent, Hengist and Horsa. And they were sort of the father figures named by Bede for the kings of Kent. So you imagine them kind of getting off the boats and then declaring themselves king. And similarly, there are other kingdoms that are mentioned, if not by Bede, then in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which is a late 9th century source originally, talking about the founding fathers of the kingdoms of Wessex, you know, Cherditch, and etc., the king of Sussex, and so on. And so you get this impression that kingdoms were there from the very first. And actually, when you look at the archaeological record, you can see there's very little differentiation differentiation in terms of social status until you get to the second half, indeed the late 6th century. So at least 100 years after the beginning of the immigration from the continent. And all of a sudden then there's this explosion of things like princely burials, you know, great big mounds, the most famous being Sutton Hoo of the early 7th century, great halls, timber halls of the kind that we haven't seen previously in the building record all of a sudden. So there's this period of intense competition between the elites, and that's when you can see kingdoms starting to form. And that's when we get the earliest reliable written evidence of kings, seems to be late 6th, early 7th century, and they're the kings that the earliest kings Bede talks about. People like Radwald of East Anglia, who may or may not be buried at Sutton Hoo. People like Athelbert, king of Kent, the one who famously welcomes St. Augustine in 597. The kings of Northumbria, who Bede is very well informed about. All of a sudden, we see this, as I say, it kind of intense period of competition between these kings. The main point, though, that I had as a misconception is that there were seven of them. And you get this phrase, the Heptarchy, which, you know, it's one of those terms, kind of like the anarchy, you know, to describe Stephen's reign. It's sort of ineradicable. But it was only coined, I think I'm right in saying, in the 16th century. The first person to talk about there being seven kingdoms is Henry of Huntingdon, who is an early 12th century Anglo-Norman chronicler. He says the Anglo-Saxons, they came, exactly the sort of traditional story I was taught, they came over and they immediately set up seven kingdoms, and he rattles them off: Northumbria, Mercia, East Anglia, Wessex, Sussex, Kent, and Essex. And it is clear that what he was doing, he was just kind of looking at the major polities that he saw in his sources, like the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle and like Bede. The reality is, as you can imagine, in a period where you've got kingdoms kind of growing up, sort of, you know, period of ferment, where kings and kingdoms are rising and falling in very aggressive competition, is that initially kingship is open to anyone who can browbeat or bully enough of his immediate neighbours into recognising him as their chief or overlord. So initially you get dozens and dozens of kingdoms. I mean, if you look at Bede, for example, Bede, I think, mentions at least a dozen kingdoms, possibly slightly more than a dozen. So that, although there are, you know, again, with all of this, other arguments, other models are available for the rise of kings. It seems to me that still the most persuasive and popular model is that kingdoms aggregate, you know, they sort of aggregate power to themselves in that period, late 6th, early 7th centuries, and there are initially lots and lots of them. The document that is undateable, that is reckoned to be late 7th century, mid to late 7th century, that gives us some light on this is called the Tribal Hidage. Nobody knows what it's for, but it looks like it was, it's just a list of peoples and numbers written next to them indicating how many hides they are responsible for. So it's reckoned to have been a way of calculating tribute, possibly for the kings of Northumbria, who are not mentioned in the document. But the main point is there are lots and lots of peoples mentioned. So you get the ones we know about that become kingdoms, like the East Saxons, the West Saxons, the kings of Kent. You also have peoples like the people of Lindsey, which is Lincolnshire, or I never know how to say this word, the Whitcher, you know, the sort of the area of Worcestershire. You can see, I think there's about 34, 35 peoples listed in the Tribal Hidage. And again, that's a snapshot from the mid-7th century. So goodness knows how many of these nascent kingdoms you had, say, in the late 6th century. Lots and lots and lots is my feeling.
So would you prefer multiplicity rather than heptarchy?
Well, I think there's a borrowed phrase from someone writing 40 years ago, but that someone said, which I quote in the book, or sort of paraphrase in the book, saying, you know, that this was kind of a... still being used, and it is a high time that the phrase heptarchy was given a decent burial. You know, we should sort of take it out, put it in a ship, and put it under a mound of earth and never speak of it again. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned a technical term there, the hide, when you were talking about the Tribal Hidage. Hide, I think, means the amount of land that was sufficient for a family. Is that right? Is that what
that's
hide
what Bede
means?
Says, yeah. It's kind of a unit of land. The origins of the hide are very mysterious. Please, please don't quiz me on them. but yeah, it's a kind of standard unit. It doesn't relate to any a sort of fixed amount of land, but it's the amount. It's the amount... that can support one family. Apparently the Germanic root of the word hide sort of implies a married couple. I take that on trust from Thomas Charles Edwards.
Okay, right. We're not going to delve any further into that. I think we've explained it, and everyone can follow that up if they wish to.
Yeah.
Right. Misconception number three. This is a good one. The conversion to Christianity was a peaceful tea and cake with the vicar affair. So you mentioned Athelbert and Augustine and 597 there and the mission from Rome. That's a pretty famous event. But what really happened with Christianity?
Well, as you'll know, I've written an article on this for BBC History magazine. And the good person to start with actually is Athelbert. because the account of here of Augustine coming in 597, of course, written by Bede. I mean, so, for so much of this period, for so much of the 7th century, we're reliant on Bede. And, you know, goodness knows what we'd do if that source didn't survive. So Bede is a really big, fat book, even in its modern English translation. It's kind of 500-plus pages, absolute goldmine, informing us about, keeping us informed about the 7th century in the way that we are in the dark, really, for the 8th century and to some extent to the 9th century. If we had a Bede for the 9th and 8th and 9th centuries, we'd be laughing. Sad thing is we don't. Bede is of course, he calls his book The Ecclesiastical History of the English People. And that what is good from Bede's point of view is if a king converts to Christianity, then they are praised. So Ethelbert is I think the first time Bede mentions him, he says he was the third king to have overlordship over all the southern English south of the Humber, but the first to enter the kingdom of heaven, because he's the first king to convert. And the way to speed this up a bit, the way Bede presents that conversion process is the missionaries come over, led in the first instance by St. Augustine. The king has a moment of clarity and converts, sees the light and converts, and then all his people follow him. So it's a very straightforward process. And the thing that that sort of troubled me in that is that, you know, when you look at the way these kings behave when Bede is not describing them, or the things that Bede sort of mentions only in parentheses, is they are brutal warlords. You know, that when they go to war against each other, they dismember each other, they put each other's heads on spikes. You know, this is all sort of mentioned very briefly in passing in Bede, this kind of thing. And the notion that this was all done sort of peacefully, and that when one of these brutal warlords converts, everyone else just kind of spontaneously sees the light and is baptized voluntarily, is something that I was reacting against in that article. The one of the sort of antidotes for this is a source I made a great deal of in the book, is the life of Wilfrid. Wilfrid, who was a bishop of Northumbria in the late 7th and early 8th centuries, who has a very controversial career and has therefore a very propagandist saint's life written up after his death. And it's much less kind of embarrassed, I think, about the compulsion in the process of conversion than Bede occasionally is, or much less reticent, say that. So when he talks about the king of Northumbria, whose name is going to escape me, no, it's Egfrith, the king of Northumbria in the 670s, pushing against the British rulers to the west. He talks about them fleeing from our hostile sword, and how all the churches that the British had fled are being given to the English church, the Northumbrian church, of which Wilfrid is head. And he talks about how, you know, God loved these Northumbrian kings as a result of this violence. And the other thing that's that struck me as a good antidote to the idea that it was all peaceful is the conquest of the Isle of Wight. The Isle of Wight is converted at sword point by conquest, a very violent, sort of almost genocidal conquest, the way Bede describes it. It's the last Anglo-Saxon polity to convert or be converted to Christianity, but it's all done at sword point. There's another bit in the life of Wilfrid where, again, it just kind of comes out quite glibly. He says that Wilfrid converted Sussex, which again is quite late to convert in the 680s. And he says, you know, Wilfrid baptized loads of people at the king's command, you know, some willingly, some unwillingly. And it's just, you know, that sort of, as I say, almost in passing, you catch out these, of course, Christian sources, very pro-conversion sources, admitting that this actually probably wasn't as voluntary and benign a process as some 19th century historians of it like to pretend, some of whom I quote in that article. So it's nothing, you know, I think one of the phrases that was floated when we were discussing this article at the commissioning stage was the word crusade. And I said, it's nothing like a crusade. It is not every instance is accompanied by that kind of level of violence, but nor was it an entirely peaceable process, the parting people from their old gods, you know, their Thunors and their Frees and their Wodens. That must have been a very fraught process, and a lot of it must have been do as you're told or else.
And a process, I guess, that was is complicated by the fact that you got Christianity also not only coming from Augustine and the East, but also from Ireland and the West, which we probably don't want to go into in any great detail. But that does
no, you're right to
matters.
Mention it though. But you're right to mention. I mean, we mentioned it very very briefly. I mean, the people coming from the North and East, you know, might seem to be more benign than the people coming from Rome, but they certainly present themselves, or rather their lifestyle is simpler, it's humbler, you know, so that these Irish monks, ultimately Irish, are going everywhere barefoot and refusing to ride horses and have simple churches and austere lives. So these people like St. Aidan, St. Cuthbert, you know, who are the polar opposite of a bishop like Wilfrid, who sort of positively, you know, rejoices in the splendor of the Roman Church. But the same, they're converting, as I say, warrior kings. You know, your Oswalds and your Oswys, who have the same power of compulsion over their subjects. So whilst the people who are providing the knowledge and providing the impetus for conversion, they may well be saintly men. They have to use, in order to effect the conversion, the raw instruments of royal power, i.e. these very violent warrior kings.
Let's talk about women, because that's your fourth misconception. The Anglo-Saxon women had better rights than women after the conquest, after 1066. So what is the place of women in this period?
Well, again, one regrettable thing is it's very difficult to say because the source material is so weak. This is something I discuss at the start of the book as part of an explanation as to why what several chapters are focused on individual men. It wasn't possible to focus a chapter on an individual woman because you know their lives are so badly documented. I mean, Bede, who we've talked about, he mentions a handful of pious women, women like St. Hild, better known as St. Hilda. But, you know, he gives us, you know, four or five paragraphs of biography of these women. And it's not then until the 11th century that we get sources that directly discuss individual women. There are a couple of queens in the 11th century, well-known queens, Edith, the wife of Edward the Confessor, and Emma, Edward the Confessor's mother, wife of both Ethelred and Canute. They both commission works which touch on aspects of their lives. But otherwise, you know, we are scrabbling around for evidence for Anglo-Saxon women. And we see them appearing in charters. We see them as witnesses to royal charters if they are queens. And we can see from their position in the witness lists and from their endurance from one reign to the next, as, you know, young kings come and go for whatever reason, we can see them persisting at court from one decade to the next, but we can't know anything about their lives. So all of which is to say that the women in the Anglo-Saxon period, very badly documented. The idea arose beginning in the 18th century and developed particularly in the early 20th century that in this period, 7th, well, particularly the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries, women had better rights than they did after the conquest, is an idea that was dismantled by Pauline Stafford in the 1990s and showed that it was kind of wishful thinking based on just a tiny handful of sources. One of the most striking things, it just seems incredible even to say it, is that one of the sort of the sort of foundations of this idea was Tacitus writing in the first century about women in Germania. So this is a Roman author writing about German women in the first century, and he says, they were sort of such good wives, and they sort of encouraged their husbands to valor, and they were so chaste, and they were so frugal. And, you know, it's absolutely sort of typical example of a quote-unquote civilized author in Tacitus praising a barbarian society who about, you know, in other respects he denigrated or couldn't care less about, but saying, well, in this respect, they are virtuous. The implication is, unlike our women, Roman women, who waste all their time hanging around the theatre or the baths, or, you know, having adulterous affairs, you know, when they should be virtuous like these German women on the other side of the cultural divide. So that is used as the basis of kind of later historians saying, well, you know, women in the Anglo-Saxon period are the same, you know, that this can be applied, what Tacitus was saying, can be applied to Anglo-Saxon society. And as, you know, without unpacking the whole of that article by Stafford, she, as I say, she takes every single kind of prop of this old argument and dismantles it. And it seems that, you know, the sad reality is that, you know, in the Anglo-Saxon period, as after 1066, you know, women's rights were not that great.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
The point is that you can still, you know, be merchants, be traders, you know, wear trousers, go to the toilet, you know, have fantastic beads, etc., and brooches. And at the same time, you or your ancestors can engage in kind of nefarious acts of violence.
Now, if Pauline Stafford was listening to this conversation, she'd want us to be talking about the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles rather than the Chronicle, because she's written about that recently. But let's leap on from that one to a misconception that I kind of dropped in, that I had a bit of a misconception about, and you weren't completely convinced. But I think there's something here that England and the Anglo-Saxons were in some way different to the rest of Europe during this period, that there was something quite specific going on in this island, in this bit of the land that they were in control of, that was somehow separate from and distinct from what was going on in Europe. So set me straight on that.
I think your suggestion was that it was a misconception that, or people thought of England in this period. Of course, when we say England, England is a word that's not coined to describe this the emergent polity of England until the late 10th century. So whenever we talk about England, it's kind of a back projection. So in the area that ultimately is described as England, I think you had suggested that, you know, people thought of it as, you know, perhaps cut off from the continent, isolated. And clearly it wasn't. I mean, we talked about Wilfred earlier, someone who goes back and forth to Rome at least three times in his life. And you can see high-ranking churchmen doing that. You can see merchants doing that. And I think, so, you know, clearly that England is not sort of entirely separate from the continent, not cut off from the continent. The idea I floated back in return is that I think there is an idea of English exceptionalism, that people, you know, people in later centuries look to the Anglo-Saxon period and say, oh, well, this was different and that was different. And I think some of those topics are things that we're going to discuss later on. I mean, one of them, for example, just off the top of my head, because I was looking at Levi Roach's book on assemblies, this idea that, you know, the English were kind of uniquely blessed or ahead of the curve in having popular assemblies, you know, in having large assemblies that kings would hold and representative assemblies. So, you know, in the 18th, 19th centuries, people looked at these assemblies and said, well, this is the beginnings of the parliamentary tradition, you know, even though they're nothing like parliaments. But as Levi points out in his book, they might not have been doing that kind of thing in Francia necessarily, but they're doing it in West Francia. But the Ottonian kings of Germany are holding similar royal assemblies, you know, with similar representative functions, and other places in Europe as well. So I think, I'm not quite sure where we're going with this as a misconception, you know, but there are, as I say, we'll come on to things, I'm sure. The idea that, I'm tying myself in knots here. I think in some ways England was different, but not in the traditional ways. That often the things that are trotted out as kind of low, well, this was a particularly English phenomenon. In many cases, you can say, actually, there are lots of other peoples in Europe who thought of the, you know, who did the same things or thought of themselves in the same terms.
Okay, we'll come back to some of those points in a moment. But one of the things that that everybody who studies this topic or doesn't study this topic knows about is that the Vikings came over in 793. They land in Lindisfarne. That's the big moment. And they attacked and beat up the Anglo-Saxons. And the misconception here, the one that you want to pick up, is that the Vikings were basically just the same as the Anglo-Saxons, but they just came from somewhere else.
It's an old chestnut, because, you know, the debate on the Vikings has been going on, you know, since forever. But there was an idea floated, I think, first in the 1960s, that the violence was basically the chroniclers who wrote about this at the time, the people who wrote about it at the time, were hysterical, that they were exaggerating the effect of Viking violence, and that the armies were smaller than reported, and really that, you know, this was not as devastating and as important as contemporary sources would lead us to believe. And, you know, and ever since then, there has been debate on this issue. It was Peter Sawyer, I think, the article that kind of that set that ball rolling. And I mean, my feeling is that the violence was terrible and destructive, and that we should give much greater credence to these sources rather than dismiss them. And as I say, these are not ideas I've formed myself. I mean, when you're doing a book that covers seven centuries, you have to develop a fairly magpie sensibility, and you are persuaded by the writings of other historians. You're not going back to the coalface necessarily in every instance. But some of the books I've read recently on the Vikings have persuaded me that, whilst you can say, yes, you know, there are things that, in many respects, in which the Vikings, you know, they weren't sort of ogres or monsters, that the scale of the devastation was very considerable. And I think that's kind of like I think it's just me reacting to that view. I mean, if you go to somewhere like the Jorvik Centre, in York, and you know, you can come away from that with the impression that, well, the Vikings wore trousers, you know, the Vikings had coins, the Vikings went to the toilet, you know, you see them doing these day-to-day things, because this is a street excavated in mid 10th century York, which of course shows them engaged in commercial activities, and it shows them engaged in domestic activities, and you can come away with the impression that, you know, that this is all, you know, pretty benign. But there's a great difference between, you know, I think I'm right in saying that actually the stuff in the Jorvik Centre actually dates from a period after they're under English rule. I think it dates from after 954, that excavation. So although it's sold very heavily as kind of like Viking York, it's actually under the rule of the Kings of England by that point. But anyway, I'm going off piste. The point is that you can still, you know, be merchants, be traders, you know, wear trousers, go to the toilet, you know, have fantastic beads, etc., and brooches. And at the same time, you or your ancestors can engage in kind of nefarious acts of violence. And, you know, I think the one of the things that kind of, for me, establishes the scale of, or the extent of Viking destruction is what's lost to us, in the fact that we know almost zippity-doo-dah about the Kingdom of East Anglia, you know, which should be what would have been one of the richest areas of England in the 7th, 8th, early 9th centuries. You know, the fact that we know almost nothing about Northumbria in the 9th century, because, and Northumbria, of course, had this incredibly rich culture we know from Bede and from things like the Lindisfarne Gospels. The fact that we're so badly informed about it in the era immediately in the centuries between Bede and the Viking raids shows just how destructive those raids were. I mean, monasticism, and for that matter, the organized church as a whole, is wiped out in the areas that the Danes settle in the first instance. So you've got, I mentioned Lindisfarne. The monastic community of St. Cuthbert, who were originally based on Lindisfarne, ultimately end up in Durham. And there's a monastic community as well in York. But otherwise, that's it. In northern England, there is no monasticism after the Vikings come along. All those famous houses, mentioned Hild at Whitby, you know, Wilfrid's houses at Hexham, etc., they're just all devastated and wiped out. Same with the bishoprics as well. The bishoprics of East Anglia and Eastern Mercia, disappear. And they're not monasticism really isn't reintroduced into those areas until after the Norman conquest. So for two centuries, you know, organized Christianity in those areas is wiped out. And that's, you know, a direct consequence of Viking destructiveness.
And of course, Lindisfarne is famous for that scary stone. Is it called the Doomsday Stone, which shows the Vikings looking like sort of alien ogres with their weapons held over their heads. So that kind of you're going on that line that they were demons.
I'm not extrapolating from a stone. I mean, the stone is just like half a dozen blokes waving swords around. It could be anybody.
But it's quite scary.
I'm going on actually as a historian who quite likes chronicles. I'm going on, you know, when chronicles say, you know, this was terrible and they took all the people away as slaves and they sold them and they destroyed everything. I'm railing against or reacting against the suggestion that, well, these people who were reporting this at the time are just exaggerating. You know, what did they know? And I just think that's just such a sort of a patronizing attitude to adopt to people at the time. Of course, you engage with these sources critically, but to dismiss their suffering out of hand, especially when the evidence of destruction in terms of the absence of the written record and the absence, the disappearance of organized Christianity speaks huge volumes about what actually went on.
Right, let's charge on to misconception number 7, that Anglo-Saxon kings were elected, which kind of you sort of touched on a little bit there with the idea of assemblies and things, I guess. So tell us whether kings were elected or not.
Well, again, this is me perhaps coming at it from the post-Norman conquest angle, but the tradition is that up to the Norman conquest, English kings were elected. And then after the conquest, it's the hereditary principle, and kings, you know, it goes from the king and his son is automatically king, and his son, the son after that, is automatically king. So there's a sense of boo the Normans with their primogeniture and their hereditary monarchy, and hurrah the Anglo-Saxons because they were proto-democrats in that they got together and they said, which of us should be king? And they chose a king. And that's the theory. And then you look at the way it goes in practice. And if you go back, go back to Alfred, but even you can go back as far as Alfred's grandfather, Egbert. You know, Egbert's succeeded by his son, Aethelwulf, who is succeeded by his sons in turn, the youngest of which is Alfred. Alfred is succeeded by his son, Edward. Edward is succeeded by his son, Athelstan. Athelstan famously doesn't have any kids, but he's succeeded by his younger brother and then his son and then a younger brother. And so it's kept in the family that way. It goes either to son or brother right up to when the Danes start to invade. So, you know, the pattern is upset in 1016 with the accession of King Canute. What happens when Canute dies? He's succeeded by his son. When that son dies, he's succeeded by his half-brother. And then we go back to the old English line in Edward the Confessor, who's the son of Ethelred. So it's kept in these families. It's kept in one royal family for nearly 200 years. It seems to me that a lot of the talk about election is derived from the accession of Harold Godwinson in 1066 itself. And, of course, Harold has no hereditary right to the throne at all. He is married to Edward the Confessor's sister, so he's the king's brother-in-law, which, you know, no one has previously said, I'm the king's brother-in-law, so, you know, I think I should be king. And so in those circumstances where it has been kept in the same family, or families, plural, two families, for a couple of hundred years, of course you and your supporters are going to stress just how popular you are and just how much of a mandate you have to govern by saying, well, everyone chose him for it. He was nominated and he was elected and everyone said, yes, he would make a great king. These earlier kings, you know, of course, yeah, when there's a handover of power, you want everybody to accept that candidate and you want to have an assembly to invest them or later to crown them, and you want them to be acclaimed. But the notion that, you know, that Anglo-Saxon kings were elected in any modern sense of the word, that they said, well, who is the most virtuous among us? And they said, Dave, we should have Dave should be king, as if you're kind of electing the class president, is just a nonsense.
That would be Athel Dave, I think, probably.
Athel Dave, yeah. No, no, Dave the Noble, yes.
The assembly, we've got this concept called the Witan, haven't we? This body of elders that's talked about a lot. So what was their role then, if in the elections, in the succession of kings?
You have the word Witan. This is where, again, sort of deep and muddy waters. The word Witan, I think I'm right in saying, is used first in, I'm trying to think when it's used in the Chronicle. It doesn't occur very much until the early 11th century. There's a lot of talk of the Witan in Ethelred the Unready's reign, so late 10th, early 11th century. A lot of talk about the king and his counsellors kind of being collectively responsible for decisions, bad decisions in many cases. And then we have talk of a word I can never say, Witanyamot, I think it's pronounced. That comes up in the 1030s, I think. These kings, they in order to communicate with their representatives, if you like, or their minions, their servants across the whole of the kingdom, they would periodically summon people together two or three times a year. And the question is to what extent are they I suppose, doing that to tell these people what to do or consult these people. And I think it probably is obviously a bit of both. I just think, and I don't want to, you know, I'm not trying to sort of say, and this is all a tinsel, you know, this is all for sort of, these are actually autocrats. All I'm saying is that it bugs me enormously when people say to me, oh, of course, the Anglo-Saxons used to elect their kings, or as if kind of like, you know, it was just virtue that determined who got to be king. If that's the case, it is an incredible run of, you know, good luck or incredible odds that it just happens to be the same royal family from one century to the next until they're overthrown by violent conquest. In the earlier period, if you go back to the sort of 7th, 8th centuries, of course, dynasties you can see switching around a lot. Although they kind of claim to have descent from some founding father, you can actually see that the genealogies are almost certainly invented, and that when power, you know, passes from one king to the next, dynasties do alter. But that's not because they had a nice sit down and a chat about it. That's because there was an incredible bun fight with massive amounts of bloodshed when these kings died. So in the earlier centuries, they're enormously unstable. And the reason they stabilize is because the certain dynasties start to, maintain power from one generation to the next by means of sacralizing their kinship or you know, actually saying my son should be king and readying him for that role and everyone accepting that as the natural order of things. So, election, no.
We had Professor Tom Licence on the podcast a little while ago, who's written a biography of Edward the Confessor, and he makes fair play of that sense of the royal blood and the importance there. So, so I think people are talking about that again and clarifying that. So, good to get your view on that. So, let's move on to misconception number 8, which is that the Anglo-Saxons believed that they were God's chosen people. So where does that come from, and what's the veracity of that statement?
Yeah, again, I'm not going to go too deep on this because it's a complex argument, and I don't say that with any, you know, I say that because I only sort of, you know, vaguely grasp it myself. But it was suggested, I mean, the idea of England, the English as God's chosen people is something that people are familiar with from the 17th century onwards, post-Reformation English. But it was suggested, I think, originally by Patrick Wormald in the 1970s that this idea actually went back a lot, lot further, actually to the Anglo-Saxon period, and starts off with Bede. And to my mind, this was fairly comprehensively blown out the water about a decade or so ago, maybe not even a decade, maybe sort of 6 or 7 years ago, by George Molyneux, who wrote a very good book on the formation of the Kingdom of England in the 10th century, but also a number of articles that were an outgrowth of his doctoral thesis, one of which was dismantling this idea that the English, that Patrick Wormald's line, that the English considered themselves God's chosen people in that very early period. And Molyneux said, well, there are a couple of very debatable bits of Bede in the original, that, you know, don't amount to much either way. But he said, when you look at the version of Bede that was the translated version, sort of late in Alfred's reign or sort of on the cusp of the 9th and 10th centuries, a simplified English version of Bede, those passages on which Wormald had built his church, as it were, are not included. And actually, you struggle to find any texts that claim what Wormald said was the case, i.e. that the English considered themselves to be uniquely chosen by God. Of course, they considered themselves a Christian people, but they didn't consider themselves to be more Christian or more chosen than any of their continental neighbours. So that, again, is not something that I would wish to drill down to in any greater depth, because it's someone else's argument. But again, it's another of those kind of posts, or rather props, supporting this idea of English exceptionalism associated with the Anglo-Saxon period. So, you know, the English had elected kings. Well, no, not really. The English were somehow unique in having representative assemblies. Well, not really. They had royal assemblies just as the Ottonian kings of Germany did. The English considered themselves to be kind of like the Israelites, kind of like God's chosen people. Again, built on very, very shaky foundations, that idea. So, yeah, that was misconception number 8. I think if there's one sort of thing I'd like to tag on to the end, it's as a misconception, it's an idea that this was somehow a golden age. That, you know, everything in this period was better and unsullied. And I'm very, very suspicious of golden ages. Of course, there were lots of things, you know, in the Anglo-Saxon period which are considered, you know, treasures, like, you know, the artistic output, you know, these fabulous gospel books, you know, these fabulous works of art that survive. You know, yeah, they are glorious. But at the same time, the society that produced them was extremely unequal. You have slavery before the conquest of a kind that you don't have after the conquest, where, you know, at least a quarter and possibly a third of people had no human rights whatsoever, were not considered to be, you know, any more valuable than the beasts in the field who they were sort of toiling behind. So, you know, we've already said that, you know, women's rights before the conquest were no better than they were after the conquest. And I think that's true for people in general. So there's always a tendency, the Norman conquest being such that the enormous watershed it is, for people to look back, as they do in later centuries, and particularly in the 17th century, they look back and say the Anglo-Saxon period was a period of kind of liberty and freedom and gloriousness. And I think that's the thing that I think is the biggest misconception. I say I'm very suspicious of golden ages, and I think we need to see these people as they were, not as sort of later centuries wished them to be.
Excellent. Well, thank you. That's busted a whole bunch of misconceptions about this this long period, going back to the end of Roman Britain right up to the Battle of Hastings. So thank you very much, Mark Morris, for setting us straight on a few things.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
That was Mark Morris. His book, The Anglo-Saxons, A History from the Beginnings of England, is out now, published by Hutchinson. You can find a link in the episode description. Mark also recently wrote a feature for the June issue of BBC History magazine on the conversion of the Anglo-Saxons to Christianity. That's on sale now and also includes features on the AIDS crisis, medieval romance, the Tulsa race massacre, and hermits through history. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. Tune in tomorrow for an episode on everything you wanted to know about the anarchy.